It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die.
As we look at the Senate coming out with a report on their investigation of the CIA and what they say is infighting over the interrogation program, we are joined by a number of guests to talk about that and wrestle with it. Our first guest is Sam Faddis. Sam Faddis, of course, is an author, retired CIA operations officer, author of numerous books, including his latest novel, Kaffa. And Sam, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
So your initial thoughts. What this thing does, at the very least, at least it purports to show a real dysfunction inside the CIA. And, you know, I remember reading the first time we met, I remember reading that first book that I read of yours that you wrote about your time in Iraq, which was, I'm blocking on the name at the moment.
Right, Operation Hotel California.
Yes, Operation Hotel California, I apologize, which was a great book. But reading that book, I'd find this report not so hard to believe.
Right, you know, well, yeah, there was certainly plenty of dysfunction. That's absolutely true. That entire operation was dysfunction, as you can read that book. So, I mean, reactions to the report. I mean, the first thing I guess I always throw out when we start talking about the enhanced interrogation thing is, look, I agree that this program was wrong. I not only agree with that now, I agreed with that at the time. And you made reference to Iraq. Well, during that time frame, you know, we interrogated, by that I mean myself and individuals under my command, interrogated a significant number of detainees, including al-Qaeda members. We did not use these techniques, which, by the way, are not historic CIA techniques. Grade B movies to the contrary. And I did not use them, and no one under my command was ever permitted to use them. I mean, for two reasons. First, not inconsequentially, because I regard it as wrong, and we're supposed to be fighting for something. And second, because it's completely ineffective and unnecessary. I mean, I never met anybody that we interrogated that didn't tell us everything we wanted to know, and in many cases agreed to cooperate with us and go to work for us. And nobody ever laid a glove on them or subjected them to any of these techniques. So, I mean, I throw that out. I throw that out as baseline. I guess I would go on to say, however, I have real problems with a move now to, you know, 10 years on to sort of pillory guys in the agency who participated in this program. I cannot vouch for every individual or every instance, nor will I attempt to do so, but the program writ large was not just directed by the president. It was briefed to Congress. It was run with all kinds of supervision and all sorts of legal advice and all sorts of medical advice. And again, I made clear my sentiments at the time, and we did not use these techniques where I was. But the fact is, now you have 10 years later, when people feel secure, now all of a sudden we want to hang people out to dry. And I have a problem with that and the perception of that.
So, I mean, when we talk about hanging people out to dry, one of the things that struck me, and I've obviously not read the report, but only read the news reports about the report, it seems as if this is alleging that the CIA leadership, directly misled Congress and the Intelligence Committee about the extent of torture and interrogating prisoners, and B, that the people they put in charge and in place were, if you believe what you're reading, were incompetent, and that many of the competent people stepped back and said, I can't do this.
Well, I mean, let me throw out the standard caveat, which is which is the old trial lawyer in me talking, one of my many previous incarnations. That, you know, I'm not going to pretend to be able to vouch for or certify the actions of every single individual in every single circumstance in a program that was worldwide, and many of those places I was not physically present. Okay, so that's obvious baseline. I grab a hold of the effectiveness piece of what you alluded to. I agree that the program was, I mean, first of all, not necessary, and you don't, I mean, not that violating moral precepts is justified by necessity, but you, you know, you don't need to do any of these things. And in some cases, doing these things, again, leaving aside the morality for a moment, produces information of very dubious reliability. What's interesting to me about the effectiveness is, as I said, this is not a historic, these are not historic Central Intelligence Agency practices. This entire idea of utilizing these techniques basically came out of contractors who originated with the Department of Defense teaching SEER school, which is where they teach guys to how to stand up. You know, we teach our own people what to do if you're captured and interrogated and so forth. And these guys brought these ideas that they had developed in this training program, having concluded that this was how you interrogate people. When in fact, the way you interrogate people, I mean, it's a primarily a psychological process, and it requires you know a lot about the person, and it requires you have time, and it requires you know a lot about your subject matter. And that's how real trained, skilled interrogators do it, not utilizing this stuff. So I agree that the effectiveness of it has been overstated. Now, to what extent that's completely deliberate, you know, with malice aforethought, that people sit down and consciously say, I know this didn't produce this intelligence, but I'm going to lie outright. And to what extent it is people after the fact trying to rationalize, or they've convinced themselves was more important, you know, I don't know. I can't ultimately judge that.
I mean, one of the things that the one quote from the report was, CIA officers regularly called into question whether the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques were effective, assessing that the use of the techniques failed to elicit detainee cooperation or produce accurate intelligence. And then goes on the commentary, and there's one piece written in the New York Times, says, nevertheless, the higher-ups ordered the methods continued and told Congress, White House, and journalists that they were having great success. I think that's where the disconnect is for the American people and people in Congress, and whether they are feigning incredulousness or whether it's real, I mean, that can be debated, but I think that goes to the heart of the matter of who's controlling what, and is it politics controlling the CIA or CIA actually controlling the functions of what they do?
Yeah, well, and there are probably instances of both, but you know, I can certainly tell you from personal experience, you started off by talking about Iraq. Well, my God,
right.
There are plenty of examples in regard to Iraq where you can be sitting on the ground telling people straight up, black and white, exactly what the reality is, and be told from Washington that doesn't fit in with somebody's preconceived notion of what reality is, and therefore, you know, thank you for your opinion. If we wanted you to have one, we would have issued it to you. We're gonna drive on with our own reality back here in Washington, D.C. As I said, having spent a lot of years in the agency before we got into this business post 9/11, I was raised in a culture where none of these techniques existed. Again, grade B movies notwithstanding. And I remember when the buzz first started going around, say, 02, 03, when I think I was in Iraq about the use of these techniques. And, you know, my stance and that of all the other senior officers in the command where we were was like, okay, I don't know what... I don't know what they're doing anywhere else, and you guys don't worry about that. This is the way we run business here, and there will be no exceptions. You don't lay a glove on anybody. If you touch somebody, we have a problem.
I know I have people listening to our conversation right now, Sam, and going, oh, I don't believe he'd never touched anybody. How could that be? They were going after the guys who were trying to kill us after they blew us up at 9/11, and that's where all this anger came from. But you're painting a very different picture. And having said that, I'm not challenging your veracity because I know you too well,
right?
But I'm saying I'm hearing people feel that at the moment,
right? So I mean, you know, when I say we're not touching anybody, obviously, if we're in the middle of a gunfight, you know, that's not what we're referring to. If we're in a situation where people are being killed, and we're talking about situations here in regard to interrogation. Somebody has been captured. Somebody has been detained. Interrogation, and I'm going to hesitate a couple of times here because obviously when we begin to get into the issue of techniques involving interrogation, there are things that, you know, just are not stuff that I can talk about fully in this setting. But what I have to stress is that this is a psychological thing. It is not necessarily a pleasant process. I'm not talking about baking people birthday cakes and becoming best buddies with the Al-Qaeda guy that we captured. But it is a question of getting to know him, of knowing the subject matter, of convincing him to talk, putting in the time. It's a lot of detail. It's a lot of hard work. For me, and this is the thing I used to stress with junior officers, is in addition to the fact that it's wrong to abuse detainees, when you get to the point where you've lost your temper and you're striking somebody, you have completely lost the bubble. You are no longer psychologically in control of this situation. You are no longer directing the situation. You are off the rails. So not only is it wrong, but we are now wasting our time. And I have literally terminated an interrogation where I was sitting in with the junior officer, second seating, when he slapped the detainee on the hand. He did it, by the way, because the detainee several times had he was uncuffed and he had gotten up and started waving his arms around, and the officer had repeatedly told him, every time you do that, I don't know whether you're coming after me or not, you have to stop doing that. Otherwise, I'm going to have to put you back in restraints. The guy stood up, started doing it again. He reached over and slapped his hand, much as we might have once upon a time slapped a kid for grabbing cookies out of a cookie jar. It's about that hard. That was sufficient for me to say, we're done here today. You've lost it. This is work, and it is a psychological thing. It's not about you abusing somebody or losing your temper.
So when you see these, and I know you've read some of the articles and have a deep sense understanding of this, so when, in conclusion, when you see the part of the report says, I'm concerned that what appears to be a lack of resolve at headquarters to deploy the brightest and most qualified officers, we see no evidence that thought is being given to deploying an A-team, somebody who they're quoting in the piece, a CIA official, a member of a team. The result, quite naturally, is a production of mediocre, or I dare say useless, intelligence. So if let's say this, for argument's sake, this report is true and that the facts in there are true, then what does that lead you and what should it lead others to do or say about what must be done in response?
Well, hopefully it leads us to do things that have already been done, which is to walk away completely many years ago from this program and to become significantly more professional and focused, well, about interrogation, which I hesitated there because in some cases it's a matter of simply going back to the way we've already always done things. I mean, my fundamental problem with this report is I don't have any problem at all with the Senate conducting an oversight investigation. That's their charter, and I fully and wholeheartedly endorse congressional oversight of intelligence. We need it. It is crucial. They want to do an investigation. They want to dig through 6,000 pages of stuff. They want to conclude produce a report with lessons learned. I'm fine. My issue is with the release of this publicly, particularly at this time. I think it gives a bad impression. I think the dominant impression that is going to come out in the press is not that we collectively as an intelligence community, the president, the Congress, made a lot of mistakes, but that the CIA went rogue again, as if this was all being done in some dark corner without anybody knowing. Those are my problems with the release of the report.
Well, Sam Faddis, once again, I appreciate you taking the time with our listeners. Thank you so much for your service, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
On our way to break, we're hearing Fight the Power, Public Enemy, from the album Fear of a Black Planet. On this day in 2012, it was announced that Public Enemy would be the fourth hip-hop group to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion, the torture memo. Stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.
We can't get careless. You say what is Six senses, seven firmaments of heaven to hell, 8 million stories to tell, 9 planets faithfully keep in orbit with the probable tenth, the universe expands length, the body of my text possess extra strength, power lifted powerless, up out of this towering inferno, my ink so hot it burned through the journal, I'm blacker than midnight.
Welcome back, this is Mark Steiner, and that's Mathematics by Mos Def. Dante Terrell Smith, a.k.a. Mos Def, a.k.a. Yasin Bey, was born in Brooklyn on this day in 1973. We're about to talk to Scott Chain, who's the national security reporter for the New York Times, who's been writing about the CIA torture report that came out early this week and is catching the country by storm. And Scott, welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. It's great to have you with us again, and thanks for taking the time. So this has been interesting, Scott. We've been talking to a bunch of folks who have worked in the CIA before, and you get the sense that this is an anomaly. They say it's an anomaly because it's not what the CIA is supposed to be about, and that, say, most people in the CIA are not only trustworthy, but are people who know how to run an operation, who never participate in this kind of torture and terror. It's against their way of thinking. To them, this seems like a huge contradiction.
So you're saying that some people say that this is an anomaly. This
yes.
is not the way the CIA usually operates.
Right, correct.
Well, it's certainly true that, on the one hand, that, you know, most of the people who work for the CIA, I don't know what the number is currently, probably 20,000 or more, are people who are analyzing, you know, what Putin's up to in Ukraine or trying to recruit, Chinese spies to tell us what China's up to. The vast majority of people, you know, we're not working in this program. But there is quite a long history of what you might call a cycle of scandal and exposure at the CIA. The most significant precedent to what's going on right now is back in the 1970s when the Church Committee, named for Frank Church of Idaho, the senator who headed that committee, had months and months and months of hearings into abuses by the CIA, by the NSA, by the FBI. And they put out, I think, 14 or 15 volumes of very, very detailed reports. And as a result of that, there was a lot of legislation passed. There was an executive order against assassination. All kinds of things resulted from that. So you've kind of seen this pattern of going to extremes and then being exposed and being subjected to some kind of restrictions. I think something that's a little bit different this time is that when the Church Committee was working, there was not, you know, a lot of what they were exposing was perhaps the most sort of frightening part of the Cold War in the early 50s when the CIA was doing a lot of extreme things into the 60s. And by the mid-70s, you know, there was detente with Russia, and there wasn't the perception on the part of most Americans that people were in grave danger. The difference now is that with the rise of ISIS and these awful beheadings of journalists and so on, I think people are kind of clued into a sense of threat, a sense of fear. So I'm not sure that we would expect quite the same round of reforms that you had back in the 70s. In fact, as we've seen, even this report, the Republicans opted out of and have denounced the Republicans on the Senate Intelligence Committee. And the White House and the CIA have taken a very kind of in-between position on it, saying some mistakes were made, but, you know, we don't want to go too far.
Someone's been covering this for a long time, but I'm curious. I've been reading your articles and the other articles by others in the Times about Charlie Savage and Mark Mazzetti and others. What does it say to you about what has yet to be revealed and what this points to? I mean, is the consensus this points to something much deeper that has to be investigated further? Or is it, you know, I mean, because there is resistance here, obviously. You're describing from both the White House, CIA, and the majority in Congress.
Well, you know, back in 2009, Senator Pat Leahy, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, had a proposal that he floated around for quite a while for a sort of truth and reconciliation commission that would look into all this stuff.
Right, right.
And his proposal was that you essentially offer people immunity from prosecution in return for full and honest testimony about everything that happened. And certainly as a journalist, I was very much in favor of that. And I think what we've gotten, you know, that was nixed, and President Obama famously said he wanted to look forward and not back. You know, I think he was wary of getting sort of turning his presidency into sort of a long-running investigation of the Bush presidency. He wanted to do health care, he wanted to do other things, and so he said, you know, he wanted to look forward and not back, and didn't support that proposal. So what you got was a, you know, sort of half measures. Certainly the Senate report done by the Democratic staff of the Intelligence Committee is a massive piece of work. The still classified full report is 6,000 pages. They supposedly looked at 6 million pages of CIA records. But one thing they didn't do was they didn't talk to anybody. They made a decision early on because there was a criminal investigation at the time, and they were afraid people wouldn't talk. They decided they wouldn't base this on interviews. They'd just base it on documents. But obviously, to do a full study of this program or of anything else, it would help to talk to the people who ran it, the people who worked on it, and get sort of eyewitness testimony. So I actually think that there is quite a bit we don't know. The other thing is that there is a dispute about the facts, and the Republicans on the Intelligence Committee and the Democrats on the Intelligence Committee have completely different facts. The former CIA officials who ran this program claim that the Democrats, the Senate Democrats report is, you know, very inaccurate. And now today you have quite an interesting development, which is that Senator Mark Udall, who lost in his reelection bid in November and will step down soon, he took the floor of the Senate and essentially accused John Brennan, the CIA director, and Obama's former very close counterterrorism aide, of essentially stonewalling the Intelligence Committee, misleading the Intelligence Committee, with the connivance, the sort of tacit support of Obama in the White House. And what he says is that in 2009, Leon Panetta, then the CIA director, when the Senate was beginning this review of records, Panetta was the new CIA chief, and he asked his people, hey, take a look at all these documents we're giving the Senate and, you know, tell me what's in there. And so there's something called the Panetta Review, which remains secret. And what Senator Udall said is that the Panetta Review pretty much lines up with the Senate Democrats' report, expose on this interrogation program, whereas the John Brennan's response to this report, the current CIA director's response, is completely at odds with that. Mm-hmm. So Udall is essentially accusing Brennan of covering up the truth that is in about this interrogation program that he says is in this internal CIA document prepared under Leon Panetta. So, you know, it's getting pretty complicated, but I think it's probably fair to say that even with this 600-page summary of the Senate report, it's hard to say that we know everything, you know, that we need to know about this program.
But it sounds as if the way you're describing this, and I was thinking about, as you were describing what was just going on with Senator Udall, that, and what you wrote about Michael Hayden, the CIA director, you the quotes you have, all those involved in questioning of detainees are carefully chosen and screened for demonstrated professional judgment and maturity, that and other things show that clearly what they were saying was not true, at least from these reports that have come out so far, that there's a lot yet to come here. I mean, it seems, I'm curious what you think the politics will be of this being revealed and what your role then as a national security journalist would be in all of this.
Well, you know, there's still stuff that is classified from World War II.
Right.
There's stuff from the Kennedy assassination that's still classified. So, you know, this could be a very long wait. I'm guessing that in, you know, 20, 30, 50 years, you know, certainly that all the documentation of this program will eventually come out, and historians will be able to come to a more complete and reasoned judgment of what happened. But I wouldn't count on that happening anytime soon, because this president, when he came in, said that he intended to run the most transparent administration in history. And as it turns out, that really hasn't happened. His administration has prosecuted a whole lot of people for giving classified information to the
right.
press on an unprecedented scale. His enthusiasm for transparency seems to have ebbed as he's gone on in office. So if he wasn't going to, make this happen, it's a little hard to imagine, who would in the short run. I do think in the long run, historians will get a hold of this stuff. But it's tough. Anyone who, I, like most reporters, file Freedom of Information requests for various documents, and it's pretty much standard to wait for years to get anything. Often the New York Times lawyers will sue when we get turned down, and sometimes you can have years of litigation to get hold of documents. For example, in June of 2010, I filed a Freedom of Information request for all the legal opinions within the Obama administration Justice Department on targeted killing by drones. And it was only this year, after fighting in court for basically 4 years, that they eventually made a couple of those legal opinions public with very heavy redactions. So, it's a real battle to get this kind of information.
And finally, before you have to run, from what you've just said, when you look at the how huge this report is, and the kind of reporting that in the Times especially has been doing around this, and the number of pages and dedicated to this and kind of probing what this is, and then you're saying earlier, well, it may be historians 30 or 40, 50 years later now when things are actually opened up, because we still haven't seen things coming out, as you said, of John F. Kennedy's assassination, and that's still being withheld. I mean, as a reporter, as somebody who kind of looks for kind of a transparency and openness to kind of create a stronger democratic dialogue in our country with a small d. I mean, this is very frustrating. I mean, when I read these things, I was really interested in seeing how this was expanding and exploding. But at the same time, in these interviews I'm doing, I find increasing frustration in realizing how little we really know, and we may never know.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can kind of overstate that, in the sense that we do know the CIA ran a bunch of secret prisons. We know in a lot of detail, what they did to the prisoners who were held there now. We do have the legal opinions that justified the torture that was done. But to really understand, especially, I think, the debate over the efficacy of torture, which some people would argue we don't really need to have, because it doesn't matter if torture works or not, we shouldn't do it as a country. But still, a lot of this debate gets down into the nitty-gritty of when a prisoner said something, and one thing the Senate report says is a lot of prisoners gave up information before they were tortured, before they were waterboarded, and so on. And that is what the CIA has sort of elided when they say a lot of good information came from this program, without saying exactly, what the use of these particular techniques has been.
Well, Scott Chain, once again, thank you for your time here on the Mark Steiner Show and for all the reporting you do. Scott Chain is a national security reporter for the New York Times. Scott, thanks so much. Looking forward to talking to you again in the near future.
Thank you, Mark. Enjoyed it.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
On our way to our next segment, we're hearing Umi Says by Mos Def. Yasin Bey, formerly known as Mos Def, born in Brooklyn on this day. Happy birthday. I don't want to take no time to write this down. I want to tell you how I feel right now.